And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday afternoon. This hour we visit with attorney and political pundit Linda Hirschman. Her latest book chronicles the history of the gay rights movement in the U.S. Her book is called Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution. And Linda Hirschman joins us from Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Could you speak up a little bit, Linda?
I will.
There we go.
Sorry.
Okay. So there's been so much progress, but so much remains to do. Isn't it a little premature to call the movement a victory? How are we defining victory?
We're defining victory as a point where there's no turning back.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, I gave that title to this project 4 years ago because I thought by the time it got written, we would be beyond the point of no return, and surely we are. But I was not arrogant enough to think that Barack Obama would announce his support for same-sex marriage 2 weeks before my book was released. So I'm, you know, happily vindicated in my optimistic title.
A lot of your book, Linda, deals with early 20th century gay culture, the furtive, hidden behavior. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So I think that it's a mistake that people often make to think that the gay revolution started in Stonewall and the revolt at the Stonewall Bar in 1969 in New York, because actually, social movements have deep roots, and they usually start when a critical mass of people gather in a critically compressed environment. And that really happened with gay people in America in the early 20th century when, like so many other immigrant groups, they migrated from the country to the city and gathered in New York, is most heavily chronicled, but also in San Francisco and Chicago and Miami. And that was, so the reason that I give so much information from that early time when gay people were not overtly claiming their rights is that they were starting to form a community. And that's usually the first step. And it was not always the terrible, closeted idea that we have of gay life from the period right before the revolution really ignited. In the 20s and during Prohibition particularly, when everyone was a criminal, being gay was not particularly noteworthy in the big cities, and gay people had, you know, gathering places and bars and baths and shows and a lot of freedom to manifest their presence that was then repressed in the 30s and 40s and emerged again as the revolution in the 60s.
Well, let's go back a little to some of these important events that you write about. Tell us, and most of us are probably unaware of them, the Mattachine Society of the 1950s and Harry Hay.
Yeah, the Mattachine Society is probably my favorite of the little noticed roots of the gay revolution. So when you think that you're, looking at something that started on 1969, you're really missing its profoundly important political origins in 1950. It actually started in the election of 1948 when Harry Hay, a confirmed communist, a serious and committed, trained communist organizer, went to a party and decided that if people could organize for Henry Wallace, who was running for president in 1948, then gays could organize for Henry Wallace also, and they could then, by exercising their political muscle, make demands on the Democratic Party for rights that we now take for granted, but that were very revolutionary at the time. So it was someone who was trained in Marxist thinking who was able to look at the situation of gays in 1948 and understand that their plight was the product of a series of political decisions to make their lives miserable, and that the solution was a political solution. When a group comes to that realization, they figure out it's not natural, it's not from God, it's a political decision that's keeping them down. When a group gets to that place, it's a critical moment in the birth of a social movement.
Linda Hirschman, touch a little bit on early lesbian behavior and how it tended to develop around what you term innocent friendships. So, oh, it's just two old maids who happen to live
right
together because they're friends, and obviously they had to keep their private behavior private.
Right. So in some sense, to try to make a lesbian life in the early part of the 20th century was easier than to make a gay male life because the society was not as threatened by the behaviors. And since male is the norm for the society, anyway, for succeeding in the society, women who engaged in male-type dressing and behaviors were not so weird and not so treated as so deviant as men who imitated women, female behaviors, because who would want to be a female unless you had to? So for one thing, lesbians had an easier way of it because it was seen as kind of normal that people would emulate their rulers. The other thing is that, you know, women have always had, as far as we know in social history, you know, community-building behaviors like innocent friendships, non-sexual friendships, and acting together and helping one another. Women have always acted collectively. So seeing them living together and engaging in warm friendships did not seem as weird as seeing men engaging in the same behaviors. So they either didn't get noticed or they were tolerated because it didn't threaten the only thing that mattered, which was the norm of maleness, of heterosexual maleness. They were not by any means happy and at ease. There's a story in the book, which I actually heard from one of the founders of the Daughters of Bilitis, which is one of the original, the sort of female counterpart of the Mattachine Society, about how she, when she and her lesbian friends would gather for meetings in her living room, they would draw the curtains so that her neighbors could not see them dancing together. So there was still a fair amount of fear and repression, but it was different.
I'd like to go back to the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. That's how you pronounce it?
Well, you know, I've heard it pronounced a million times.
Okay, well, however
it's
pronounced.
It's a made-up person. I mean, it was this hypothetical Greek person that
I see.
Sort of made up.
So. I see. What is this oppositional consciousness?
So oppositional consciousness is the realization that your situation is the creation of other people, okay? Other people are holding you down, or what we call politics is holding you down. So when people come to the realization that their problems and their oppression and their reduced status is the product of human decision-making, then they can rebel. If you think it's natural, then wanting to change things is like wishing you could fly without an airplane, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you think that God put you in that situation, then wanting to change it is heresy. So only when you realize that, and if you think it's bad, just not even sinful, but just immoral and bad, then trying to, you know, advocate for your good treatment would be upside down because you would be saying, treat me well even though I'm acting badly. Only when people come to the understanding that their oppression is from a decision made by their rulers can they rise up and form a successful social movement. And all social movements have that moment. I mean, there is in the feminist movement two such moments. One was when the abolitionists in the 1840s wouldn't let women speak at abolitionist meetings. And in our time, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, the critical moment was the publication of a bunch of books in the early 60s, including The Feminine Mystique. That was a moment when someone said, look, you're being stuck in a house in the suburbs with no reliable income, and no use for your capacities, is not natural. It's not women's natural fate. It's a result of a decision, a series of political and social decisions that you can change. And that came to the gay revolution in the form of Harry Hayes' brilliant insight in Bachelors for Wallace in 1948.
Oh, is that what it was called?
Yeah, that was his campaign to organize, quote, bachelors, unquote, single men, right? For Henry Wallace, who was the left-wing candidate of the Democratic Party. And then it took a couple years for Harry to find anyone who would join him because they were so scared. And they thought that they were bad, and they thought they were sinful, and they thought they were crazy, and the society was telling them all those things. So it took a while for Harry to find enough people to make a movement. When he did in 1950, that movement lasted in some form until Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
And after Stonewall, the first meeting that the rebels in New York had after Stonewall was at the offices of the Mattachine Society. So it was really critical that it was founded and that it survived until the more radical faction could arise in the 60s.
We're speaking with Linda Hirschman. She's a labor lawyer and an award-winning professor, scholar of other social movements, and author. And this book is entitled Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution, How a Despised Minority Pushed Back, Beat Death, Found Love, and Changed America for Everyone. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Linda Hirschman. She's the author of Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution. If you'd like to join in the discussion, you're certainly welcome. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and email radio@WLRN.org, and Twitter, that's @topicalcurrents. Tell me, Linda Hirschman, the early attitudes, differences in attitudes on the U.S. coasts versus, say, the Midwest and the South to homosexuality.
Oh, that's an interesting subject. So I think you have to make an exception for Chicago, where I happen to be while we're talking, because there was a very robust and successful gathering of gay and lesbian people in Chicago, and as well as in New York and San Francisco, and less smaller gatherings, but still substantial, even in places like Buffalo. So essentially, I think one of the differences between urban and not urban, urban centers have always been a haven for nonconformists. And they, wherever in the country they were, there was always a very robust gay community in New Orleans, for example. The cities would be better places for gay people. It is the case that in every social movement in America, the states of the old Confederacy have always been the last to change. So that, you know, I don't need to tell your listeners about the racial civil rights movement, which is being so much in the news this week. But people, so many people don't know that only two of the 11 states of the old Confederacy voted to ratify the amendment giving women the right to vote. And if you look at and only two of the states of the old Confederacy voted to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. And if you look at a map of the United States now that reflects where same-sex marriage is allowed as a matter of state law, you see again that the South is the place where no change has occurred. So you get enclaves, they say red states, blue cities, like South Florida, but generally, it is the case that the South and the Rocky Mountain West, which was heavily populated by people coming from the Confederate Army after the Civil War, are the places where social change comes the slowest.
You've worked in and written about social movements all your life, and you say that This movement is the most, some would say, the only successful progressive social movement of the last 40 years.
Yeah.
Why do you say that? What about the civil rights movement and the feminist movements?
Well, 40 years would be from 1973. Okay, so I would put most of the accomplishments of the civil rights movement at before that. I certainly do believe the civil rights movement was a successful progressive movement. I would not write a book about the civil rights movement and call it victory because the economic injustice is still so profound that I would be hesitant to say that. But certainly as far as formal equality is concerned and opportunity is concerned, the racial civil rights movement was a very great accomplishment. The feminist movement would have to question. Women have achieved formal legal equality, and that process took place within the last 40 years. It dates back to 1971, and I believe came to its fruition in 1996. So formal legal equality for women has been achieved. But, you know, there is such a residuum of the second shift and the pushing women back into the home and the ramping up the job of motherhood and the feminization of poverty and so forth that I don't actually think that can be characterized as a completed successful social movement.
Your book, Get to Work, A Manifesto for Women of the World, you say that you compare the failure of value-free choice feminism to the increasingly successful value-driven gay movement.
Right.
Would you explain that?
Good question. You've done your homework. So I believe that in America and probably, you know, most of the societies of the Enlightenment West, where social change can happen in a great way, in a meaningful way, that there's two arguments you can make. You can say, hold your nose and look the other way while I do something disgusting, like go to work and put my children in daycare, okay, as if they had no father. And or you can say, look, what I'm doing is a good thing to be doing. I am not asking for your tolerance. I'm asking for your approval, your respect at least. And that is a mistake that women made when they tried to defend women's right to abortion, to control their own reproductive fate, as a matter of, quote, choice, unquote, as if you were picking a new winter coat. And people confronted with that say, you know, I'm going to make a moral argument against you. I'm going to say it's murder. And you say it's your choice, you're going to lose that argument. And the gay revolution, because they were tarred so badly as evil and sinful and crazy, had to, and recognized relatively early, that they had to argue not that people should hold their noses and look the other way, but rather that they had to have respect for their social, sexual, romantic relationships. And that's a much more powerful way to achieve social change. If you can convince people to respect you and not merely tolerate you, you're going to get a lot further.
So that's what you mean when you say it succeeded because at critical moments its leaders made a moral claim?
That is correct. They made a moral claim. If you look, I mean, it's been the case, if you look backward, all the way back to Harry Hay, who said, look, I am a good person, okay? I am not crazy, sinful, and so forth. But you can take very clear examples of what I'm describing from the same-sex marriage movement. Essentially, the same-sex marriage movement, the marriage equality movement, made an overt argument. They said, this is love. This is a good thing. This is commitment. This is a good thing. This is mutual support. These are good things. We are telling you we are good. We want to do a good thing. And it worked in astonishingly short amount of time.
Again, our call-in line, you're welcome to join in. 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. First caller, this is Stephen in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Linda?
Hi.
Hi. Listen, I have a story. I have so many things to say, but I'll try to wrap it up in a minute or two. I was on the operation that's depicted in the movie Platoon. I was in the 196th Light Infantry.
Oh, my God.
And the things that I saw on the screen, I experienced most of those, but it's just compressed in Hollywood time. All right. When I came back home, I joined Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I sat in at the first men's conference at Student Vote Center in NYU with Warren Farrell and 50 to 75 other men. And it's been a long journey since then. But I still maintain that as I participated in the audience when an SDS convention was, the day I remember, I'll never forget it, where the Weather Underground, they became the Weather People. And they were debating that issue. The issue was race or gender, racism versus gender.
Right.
And I still maintain to this day that unless we crack the nut of what it is to be a man in this world, we will not make much progress regarding racism. So I want to conclude with that comment. Any response, please?
Well, that might be right. I thought you were going to say something different, which is that in the movement to change the meaning of what it means to be a successful man, there has been no greater ally than the gay revolution.
Yes, yes.
By blurring the lines of acceptable gender behavior and making gender a continuum rather than a binary category, they have helped enormously with that task. The question about whether maleness drives racism is maybe beyond my pay grade.
Well, I live in the skin of a biologically male, and I can tell you that one of the biggest fears is being, cuckooed behind one's back, regardless.
So, that's what I was thinking you were getting at. So,
yeah.
Right. So there is this business about race as a gateway to reproduction, and the idea of the purity of the racial group, and so sexual access to the females of the racial group is very crucial to maintaining a racist society. That is true, but I don't know if you're not putting the cart before the horse. I think that racism drives the fear of sexual access rather than the reverse.
Again, our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN.
One thing I wanted to ask you also, Linda, is you say that the gay rights movement has achieved more because it's come from further behind.
Right.
And I'm thinking that one can hide their sexuality where you can't hide your race or your gender.
Right.
So doesn't that make it easier?
No, it just makes it harder because the ease with which you can go into the closet means that the movement is always weakened. It's the ever-present temptation of the closet. And when people can hide in the closet, they're what we call free rioters. They're on the activists who pay the social price of coming out. So activists pay the social price, come out. They lose job opportunities. They get, attacked on the street. They, all the terrible things that happened to the people who tried to organize a gay revolution. They pay a huge price. And the people who are hiding in the closet get the benefit of the social change that the activists bring about, and they don't have to contribute to it. So it makes it really hard to recruit for the movement. When your natural allies have an exit, they can always escape to the closet. Secondly,
which of course has its own difficulties.
Exactly, that is exactly what I was going to say. Secondly, the option to go into the closet is not the remotest relative to changing the world to make it a good and open place for gay people. Everyone, who knows a gay person that's been trapped in the closet for whatever reason knows what a high price they pay for that life. And so the people who are in the closet have not magically transformed themselves into heterosexual people and therefore leading unimpeded heterosexual lives, they're suffering anyway.
Exactly. We're speaking with Linda Hirschman. Her book is entitled Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution. And we're going to take another short break. We'll be right back.
And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Linda Hirschman. We're talking about her book, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution. And we'll go back to some of our callers. Next up, it's Lewis in Miami. Hi, Lewis.
How you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Yes, I had a question for Linda, and actually I have two of them. Very quick, though, and I'll take my answer, you know, off the phone. Linda, what about the respect for normal families?
I mean, normal in
church.
Well, you know, I think that one of the many wonderful things to come out of the marriage equality movement has been the understanding that when people can love each other in one context, it does not take away from the ability of people to love and support and honor each other in another context. So not only is there no social science evidence to demonstrate that same-sex couples in any way reduce the happiness or well-being of opposite-sex couples, but you know, it sort of defies common sense unless you think there's a limited amount of love around, and I hope that's not right.
Let me ask you one more thing, just quick. Do you consider homosexuality as a normal thing?
Yes, I think that people come in all sizes, shapes, and varieties. And since it's so common in the natural kind, of course it's normal.
So you do consider it as a normal thing?
Yes, of course I do. I mean, otherwise...
But eventually, what I see happening is that eventually a man is going to want to marry a monkey.
I think that's a relatively insulting analogy because human beings... I mean, one of the...
I'd like to go to that wedding. I think it'd be hilarious.
Now, stop that. Do not take that bait. No pun intended. But this is an argument that gets made a lot, and what it does, of course, is to compare the love and commitment between two manifestly human beings of the same sex or not to the love between a human being and an animal. And at the risk of sounding like a speciesist, I actually think that human beings with our capacity for speech and reason are different in kind from the animals, and that two gay people loving each other is comparable to two straight people loving each other and not comparable to a human species person loving a representative of another species, although I do love my dog, although not in that way.
Good for you. One of the other contentions you make is that the battle for gay rights, and I found this very interesting, has expanded opportunities for millions of Americans who do not identify as LGBT. How do you think it's accomplished that?
Well, my favorite example of that is the way in which the public and social manifestation of the gay movement and gay people among us in our families and our friends and in public and so forth has liberated women from the rigid categories of gender expectations and gender behavior. So that's why I called the book and Changed America for Everyone. That was my inspiration to call it that. The other thing that's really great about the gay revolution, I love doing this book in case you haven't figured that out, is that they were so unbelievably clever and strategic about the way they ran their movement that the movement is an inspiration for other movements, whether it be the immigration movement or the green movement. Any movement that's come since the gay revolution can learn very, very important lessons from how they succeeded.
Hmm.
So if you, you know, I am famous for having written a really very pessimistic article about Occupy Wall Street. I looked at Occupy Wall Street and said, I know what makes movements succeed. I just finished writing a book about the gay revolution, and this one's not doing it. And, you know, I took a lot of heat for it, and sure enough, here we are 2 years later, whatever it is, and although they may have changed some of the conversation, they did not change the society and are pretty much nowhere to be seen. So there's a reason for this. The gay revolution has lessons that it could teach anyone who wanted to change the society how to do it. And insofar as people learn those lessons, they're going to succeed in changing the society.
And it's the things you've talked about until
right.
now.
You know, concentrate on your own interests first when you're at the nascent stages. When you're getting started, you are not going to change international capitalism before you get rights for gay people. Concentrate on your own interests, make a moral claim, and have weekly meetings.
I remember back in the days of Anita Bryant, do you think that her campaign in the 70s galvanized the gay movement? Do you think it had that kind of an impact?
So the first reaction was very bad because gays and lesbians had been getting civil rights ordinances passed in the places where they gathered and began to organize the cities, the liberal college towns, right?
Right.
And so they had been making some traction, and it was very important. I mean, people saw, you know, one of the things that people don't realize is how much gays and lesbian people really suffered from the violence that was directed against them and from the discrimination in the workplace. So any advances that they made were really, really important. And Anita Bryant's campaign succeeded in reversing by referendum, popular vote of the people, direct democracy, rather than from the city councils and stuff. She succeeded in reversing a lot of those advances. So for a lot of real people on the ground, life was worse for a long time because of Anita Bryant. However, finally, as they portray very interestingly in the movie Milk, people started resisting it. People went too far. They went too far in California with a proposed law to strip to exclude gay people from teaching school. And there was resistance. And once the resistance took hold, then, of course, it gets easier to build resistance on resistance. And the Anita Bryant movement gave rise to a law that was passed in Colorado by referendum, which forbade gay the political institutions in Colorado from protecting gays in any way. They amended the Colorado state constitution to say, okay, Boulder, you can't help your gays. We're forbidding you as a matter of state law. That then gave rise to the first successful constitutional case. And so in a sense, Anita Bryant could be considered the mother of the single most important legal decision in the gay revolution, a case called Romer versus Evans. If you look at the recent decision about the Defense of Marriage Act, you see it's written by the same justice who wrote Romer versus Evans. So thank you, Anita Bryant, for provoking the state of Colorado to pass that ghastly law, which was then challenged in the Supreme Court of the United States and struck down as unconstitutional in the first case to uphold the rights of gays and lesbians as a matter of equal protection.
Let's go back to the phones before our break. This is David in Hollywood. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I was a member of the Mattachine Society in New York, and an offshoot of the Mattachine Society was the West Side Discussion Group, which eventually became an independent organization.
Right.
And
hi, nice to talk.
I attended my first meeting of the discussion group in 1959. Pardon me, at which time it was so secret that there were no mailings about where the meeting would be held. The meetings were held in people's living rooms. You had to contact the Mattachine Society and be told where the next meeting would be. I was involved for 10 years before Stonewall.
Right.
And I fought a legal case, pardon me, the ACLU fought a legal case for me. I was given a ticket one night for walking on Riverside Drive, and there was nobody else around, but they claimed I was in the park after midnight. And the ACLU defended me, and we won a smashing victory, that the police did not have the right to forbid walking on the sidewalk of a city street. I was not actually in the park. I was on the sidewalk. I lived on Riverside Drive, and I said, I have the right to walk on Riverside Drive. And the ACLU used my case in their publicity for a couple of years after that happened.
Well, it is an honor to speak with you. The people who were active in those years are the real heroes, because it was so hard.
We eventually became much more public and met in various places in Midtown Manhattan, and were eventually getting as many as 200 people on a weekly basis.
Right. I in the book I write about two things, and I think that you lived them. And one is that the 60s itself really helped the gay revolution, as it helped so many initiatives for social change. The reproductive rights movement that I was just talking about is a product of the 60s as well. So the 60s had an impact on the Mattachine, New York, for sure, and so that was, like, really important. The other thing is that 60s people came to Mattachine, New York, with different ideas about what you could and could not do, and they radicalized it, and they expanded its reach. The conventional story about Stonewall is that Stonewall happened, and all these really hip characters displaced the old guys from the Mattachine Society. And it is, in fact, the case that after Stonewall, the Gay Liberation Front and then the Gay Activist Alliance did ultimately displace the Mattachine Society. But the guys who were running the Mattachine Society in the late 60s, before Stonewall, were already pretty radical themselves and pretty activist. I want to give a shout-out to the ACLU also. They weren't always on the side of the gay revolution, but they, by the 60s, they were. And the Sexual Privacy Project, which they ran and funded, was a very, very important force for bringing the gay revolution into the mainstream and starting to litigate just the kinds of things that you're talking about, which is the ACLU's strong suit. So they put a rights framework around the social movement, and that's always, you know, I talked before about what makes a successful social movement, and it is almost always the case that putting a rights framework around the social movement is an element to a successful movement.
Again, we're speaking with Linda Hirschman. She's a labor lawyer, political pundit, and an author of Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution. We're going to take one more short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman here with Linda Hirschman, a labor lawyer, political pundit, award-winning professor, and scholar of other social movements. And her latest book is Victory, the Triumphant Gay Revolution. You don't mind if we don't say the whole title, do you?
No, I don't.
And the end of it, and changed America for everyone.
Right.
Okay. What did I want to ask you? I just lost it.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. How do you expect President Obama's legacy to be viewed by the LGBT community?
I think it will be well viewed. You know, he is not a profile in courage by any means, but he's done a lot, and a lot more, certainly, I mean, than any previous president did. He was operating in a social context in which he could do a lot more because the movement had really done the work. So the movement created a social climate in which President Obama could do the right thing. But we've all seen lots of presidents who don't do the right thing, even when they can. And he did do the right thing in the marriage equality and in the don't ask, don't tell, especially. So I think that, is he Lyndon Johnson, racial civil rights movement? No. But he did do the right thing, and I think he will be well remembered.
How did the HIV and AIDS explosion of the 80s and 90s affect gay political and civil rights.
So there are two theories about this. One is that it derailed a movement that was already up and running and making lots of good progress after Stonewall, okay? And there were, you know, there was Harvey Milk, and there were laws starting to get passed, and so one theory is that that ghastly plague just robbed the movement of its best and brightest advocates and diverted all the fundraising and all the energy and effort to coping with the emergency. The other theory is that it was like rocket fuel for the movement, because nothing concentrates your mind like the imminent threat of your own death. And it did involuntarily out an enormous number of people who then lent their talents and resources to the movement. And so when they finally got the drug cocktail in 1997, the amount of money available, even to institutions that weren't primarily about AIDS, like Lambda Legal is the NAACP Legal Defense Fund of the gay movement. Lambda Legal had a lot more money, in 97 than they did in 81. And so it unleashed a flood of money. And finally, my theory about it, going back to the moral argument, is that watching gay and lesbian people taking such unbelievably loving care of one another when the disease struck, and in all those terrible years when there was no treatment and the people were so desperately sick and needy, watching the community act in that way gave them a tremendous... And by the way, this is for you, man-marrying monkey caller. Watching these human beings exhibit such empathy for one another gave them a moral standing that they had been deprived of by the accusations that they were sinful and abnormal and crazy. So it was a real demonstration of moral behavior and very persuasive. It's hard to tell people who just want to go to the hospital and be with their dying lovers that they aren't entitled to do that or to marry.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave them a lot of moral currency.
We're getting a little short on time, but let's go to another caller. This is Warren in Del Rey. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Interesting topic as we come up on the Jewish holiday season and Yom Kippur, where the chapter of the Old Testament, the 18th chapter of the book of Leviticus, that deals with all the forbidden sexual relationships is read, and is basically the origin of the prohibitions. And it would be very hard to imagine that anything is going to change the mindset of religious people who believe that the Creator commanded against certain things. But on that topic, if we're going to, and I know there are all kinds of people out there, and I've had them as friends and acquaintances and co-workers, and that's fine. But if we're going to allow that homosexuality is perfectly okay, there are those who would say, well, then we have to start allowing incest, bestiality, and certainly statutory rape, which is all over the place. And
Warren, we're kind of short on time.
That's it.
Let the author
thank you.
Comment.
Please, Linda,
on that.
Go ahead.
So, there are a bunch of answers. One is, that's why you should pardon the expression, God invented the First Amendment. So it's one thing to have, like churches say, we think this is sinful and just like bestiality. And if you want to go to a church that says that, you should be free to go to that church. But it should not drive public policy. We should not be deriving our criminal law and our discrimination law and so forth from the writings of the Old Testament, because that would like leave everybody but Jews out, for one thing. The other thing is that I'm always hesitant to, there are arguments against, bestiality and having sex with minors, which have nothing to do with whether they're the same sex or opposite sex. So it would be relatively easy for me as a lawyer to say you can forbid statutory rape and not forbid same-sex marriage. You're talking about children who are entitled to a chance to reach
a certain level of development before they're confronted with all of the issues involved in a sexual relationship. So that seems to me to be an easy question. The idea that you would take your civil law in a free society like the United States and derive it from the Book of Leviticus is a little scary.
Linda, we're running out of time, and we just have maybe about 30 seconds, but where do you see the movement going from this point?
Well, that's actually a good question. I think one of the things that's happening, which is delicious, is that transgendered and transvestite and bisexual people are coming into their own. So the idea of sexuality as a continuum, which the gay revolution really advanced, is now starting to be developed in a very interesting way, and those people are finding a gateway to a fulfilling life, you know, which is really a great development in the gay revolution, that it's being that degree of understanding of you know, the blurriness of sexual boundaries is extending now to people who've suffered greatly in the past. So that's one place that it's going for sure. The other place that it's going, in my opinion, I mean, I think there's going to be eventually a decision saying that the Constitution forbids the states to forbid same-sex
marriage.
I think eventually there will be a Loving v. Virginia for gay people. But while we wait for social change to get the Supreme Court to the place where they're comfortable, I think we're going to see some developments on the international front. I'm very interested in this Russia thing.
Oh, yes,
it's been a very pleasant hour to spend with you, Linda Hirschman.
Yes, thank you. A labor lawyer and the name of her and political pundit, her latest book, Victory, The Triumphant Gay Revolution. And we'll have a link to the book on our website and on our Facebook page. Thank you so much, Linda.
And thank you for a wonderful interview.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program is an At Your Service edition, which looks at prospects of today's South Florida real estate market. Lower lending rates and higher down payments have provided a more stable environment. Again, free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information and discussion at the Topical Currents Facebook page. And to the calendar. On this day in 1908, 105 years ago, the birth of President Lyndon Johnson in Stonewall, Texas. Historians consider him the most effective Senate majority leader ever. When JFK offered Lyndon the VP on the 1960 Democratic presidential ticket, he didn't expect Johnson to accept it. And on this day in 1937, 76 years ago, the birth of singer and actor Tommy Sands in Chicago. As was Elvis, he was under the wing of Colonel Tom Parker. He was married to Nancy Sinatra for 5 years. One more, on this day in 1943, 69 years ago, the birth of actress Tuesday Weld. A model as a child, she had a mental breakdown at age 9 and suffered from alcoholism at age 12. She also had an affair with Elvis. And a quote from LBJ, "If one morning I walked on top of the water across the Potomac River, the headline that afternoon would say, 'President can't swim.'" Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Next, get into the here and now from NPR News.